This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. The New Hampshire House's long debate over health care for low-income Granite Staters ended this week when House lawmakers voted to continue Medicaid expansion for two more years. Republican Stephen Schmidt of Wolfboro explained his support.
48,000 fellow citizens will lose their health care, and New Hampshire will not benefit from the inflow of $850 million federal dollars. I don't see any reward for this scenario.
The House also approved a 10-day residency requirement for New Hampshire voters. Earlier proposals favored a 30-day requirement, but Republican Representative Will Gannon, sponsor of the 10-day bill, called it a good compromise.
That's why I offer you a reduction from 30 days to a 10-day domicile bill. I'm giving you two-thirds of the loaf, so the fewest number of possible voters will be affected, while still eliminating non-New Hampshire voting.
Meanwhile, a House member resigned, three-term lawmaker Kyle Tasker, who was arraigned on felony charges last week, including one count of using a computer to lure a minor for sex. Here's House Clerk Paul Smith reading Tasker's resignation letter.
Dear Speaker Jasper, I am writing to resign my seat as representative from Rockingham County District 2. I appreciate all your courtesies during the time I have served in the New Hampshire legislature. Sincerely, Kyle Tasker.
And while some Granite Staters cheered the recent warm weather, maple syrup producers say this winter's higher temperatures hurt their efforts. At an environmental gathering this week, UNH forester Stephen Robert said these warm periods really shorten the maple syrup season.
If it gets too warm too fast, then that warm snap in the spring stays for a long time. It's sustained. The wood fibers that are allowing the sap to flow out of the tree get plugged up with bacteria that grow in the warm conditions.
It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange. Let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests this week are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, good to see you.
Great seeing you, Laura.
Also with us, Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter. Josh, thanks for taking time out.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic school scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, as always, thanks for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, it was a long night at the State House, gentlemen. And Josh, I really appreciate you especially taking time out because I know it was a busy day for you yesterday. Let's talk, first of all, Josh, about that vote on Medicaid in the New Hampshire House earlier this week. What are the particulars of this House bill, Josh? Because there were some changes from the original.
Well, the biggest, in terms of what happened on the floor in terms of the voting, the biggest – well, this would reauthorize Medicaid for another couple of years, and it would rely on contributions from insurance companies and hospitals to make up the reduced federal component,
right,
of the funding.
Right, which drops down to 90%.
It used to be fully funded, and it's on a sliding scale, and so – insurers and hospitals essentially agreed that they would kick in the rest because uncompensated care drops for hospitals and insurance premium tax money is good for insurers have more people enrolled and there's insurance premium tax money also. So that was the deal, and not having direct taxpayer contribution to this was essentially a sticking point for Republicans in the House. And once that came together, the big question was whether or not the bill would be severable, which hinges around something that a lot of House Republicans really wanted, which would be a work requirement for beneficiaries of expanded Medicaid. And there's a question of, well, it's questionable whether CMS would approve that component. Center for Medicaid and Medicare. And the vote on that amendment, the severability, was actually a tie vote. And Speaker Jasper,
a tie vote. Wow.
Speaker Jasper cast a decisive vote. So that was a big deal. The final vote was a big margin, but the key vote was really the severability. And Speaker Jasper broke the tie.
So, Dean, what does that mean then, that if the federal government says, no, New Hampshire, you can't have this work requirement, Medicaid expansion goes forward anyway? Is
yes,
that what that means?
That's exactly right.
So that was a big deal for Speaker Jasper, as Josh says.
Absolutely. You know, this is a number of – there have been a discussion of a number of these requirements that Republicans wanted added to the bill where you need a federal waiver. The work requirement is one example. And my understanding is the federal government has not approved that in the past. So the question was, you know, if you don't get that – is then the whole thing basically canceled. And what that tie vote broken by Speaker Jasper says is no. Even if the federal government comes back and rejects the work requirement, the program still goes forward.
Wow, so that's a big political statement on his part.
I think there's no doubt that clearing the House was the big problem. I think it's going to get it'll have an easier audience in the Senate. And my guess is Governor Hassan will be pretty eager to sign it.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
It's interesting, this issue about the severability. I mean, I think it was kind of an attempt by opponents to kind of put a poison pill in there in a way, you know, and I think they obviously came very, very close to succeeding. I don't know if the Senate would have accepted
they would have
it.
Like,
yeah.
They would have stuck it back in, yeah. And we would have this fight again later.
Exactly,
in the
exactly. And it was interesting. And I'm Josh was there, but so you know I had other things to do, like sleep last night. But but you know I would imagine that the Speaker, he probably was prepared to break the tie, but I don't know if he really was expecting to have to break the tie, that the vote was so close on the severability.
What about that, Josh?
Well, I mean, I think they knew it was both sides on this knew that that question was going to be touch and go, but, you know, nobody counts votes that well.
Well, election law has also been a big topic in addition to Medicaid expansion at the State House this year, including a bill that did pass, Josh, for a 10-day residency requirement. Now, these bills have come up before. Governor Hassan has vetoed 30-day requirements in the past. But what was the push for this particular bill this time around?
Well, same push as for its predecessor bill that the governor vetoed, which is concern that New Hampshire's election laws allow for what critics would call drive-by voting, that you can, you know, the same day of registration combined with the precedent on terms of domicile versus residence. And you know, Republicans have wanted to tighten up election laws on this point, you know, for years. And there's concern that campaign workers vote. There's concern that college students vote. On the other side, Democrats would say that this disenfranchises people who are entitled to vote and could affect people who just moved for professional reasons, members of the military, et cetera. You know, it's not a surprise that this passed in the House, and it would likely pass in the Senate, and it will, you know, there's a good chance it gets vetoed. The governor said she hadn't looked at this specific proposal yet, but she said she would be troubled if she concluded that the bill disenfranchised eligible voters. And when they start saying they're troubled, that tends to mean I'm going to be vetoing.
Pretty good.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and yeah. Dean, the particular push this time around includes, and Josh is right, we've talked about these bills for a long time,
sure,
but includes those videos that were released shortly after the primary by Project Veritas.
Yeah, absolutely. This is, as Josh suggested, this has been an ongoing battle between Republicans and Democrats over whether or not the current system as it exists in New Hampshire is susceptible to voter fraud. And there's just a lot of debate about whether or not there really is voter fraud. There have been these kind of high-profile moments in the last couple of elections where you get these videos that purport to show people either circumventing the process or suggesting how you might circumvent the process. And so there's just a debate about how susceptible the system is. But here in New Hampshire, there's just this ongoing discussion about, you know, domicile versus residency requirements. Republicans tend to target college students who they don't feel are really invested in the politics of the state. Campaign workers, as Josh mentions, is another one we always hear. So this is going on around the country, not just in New Hampshire. And I think the sense was that, well, you know, Governor Hassan rejected the 30-day residency, so maybe 10 days would be a compromise to get on the books. But my guess is that she probably would. Troubled is a very good code word for not going to happen.
Well, first of all, I mean, it is a national issue, and I understand that Governor Hassan, who's running as a, you know, for the U.S. Senate, that this is not exactly something that she wants to be supporting a residency requirement when nationally the Democratic Party, Democrats almost everywhere are voting against or are working against the residency requirements. The other thing I wanted to mention, I had this experience that night at my town meeting. Go to vote at town meeting, just walk in there, say, I'm Jeff Feingold. They check me off. They don't ask me for my ID or anything. They ask my photo. I was going to ask, what are the rules here? Why I can go vote on my town budget?
So Dean could have walked in and said, I'm Jeff Feingold.
Walked in, yeah.
But don't you think you're sufficiently well known?
Yeah, they have my name over where the bad checks are.
So you're saying it's sort of a different process, it's a different level.
But it's a different, but it's voting. And you know, I'm
on your budget.
Why aren't they, concerned about those things, elections. Just a question.
Absolutely. And a good one. And I also want listeners to join us with their questions and comments as we wrap up the top stories of the week around the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. By the way, a couple Facebook comments on this 10-day residency requirement. Len says voting is a right. What is the state doing to promote voting, not disenfranchise voters? David says no right is absolute. All rights have responsibilities. Thanks to both of those gentlemen for their comments on Facebook. You can post a comment on Facebook, too. Find us on Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or, of course, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And, Dean, I want to turn to you first on this one, because I know transportation is one of your favorite topics. The House this week voted against $4 million for commuter rail. Now, this was not to start building commuter rail. It was to study and plan. Before we talk about this, guys, I do want to play a little bit from Greater Manchester Chamber of Commerce President Mike Skelton. He was on our show on Tuesday discussing this issue. He supported funding to study the project.
This is simply too big of an economic opportunity for New Hampshire to not continue talking about and to not have all the facts before we make a decision on it.
So again, that's Mike Skelton from the Chamber of Commerce in Manchester. And what's your take on this rejection of $4 million, Dean?
Not surprising to me. It was included in, I believe, a committee recommended putting it in. And then it's been taken back out by the House. It's interesting. You know, you periodically there are these issues that serve as a litmus test between the parties. You know, in the past, it's been abortion and gay marriage. But right now in New Hampshire, if you want two good litmus test issues between Republicans and Democrats, commuter rail and minimum wage. We also had yet another minimum wage bill defeated as well. So those are two issues that, you know, as long as there's a Republican state legislature, you're not going to get commuter rail. You're not going to get an increase in the minimum wage. It's just those are two issues that really divide the parties. Now, we've talked before that there are some business Republicans in Nashua and Manchester who think this would be a very good thing. But most conservatives say simply it's too expensive. It's going to be about $240 million. It's going to be heavily federally subsidized. And there is this kind of issue of a freedom of choice and liberty to drive cars if you want to drive them. I've talked about that before. Conservatives really hit this as sort of a backdoor attempt by green liberals to get people out of their cars and into trains. I've heard that many times. So I don't think it's gonna happen anytime soon.
Well, here's an opponent. This is Republican John O'Connor of Derry, again speaking in the New Hampshire House, voting down $4 million in mostly federal aid to explore extending commuter rail from Boston to New Hampshire. Let's hear.
To be realistic, there is far higher priority that these funds can be utilized for, such as addressing many of the red-listed bridges and the desperately delayed road repairs.
So this was the argument, Jeff Feingold. Even though this $4 million was mostly federal money, still, you know, opponents like Representative O'Connor said, look, okay, let's say we decide to study this. Let's say we decide to move ahead. How can you take that money away from existing infrastructure needs?
And there are extreme infrastructure needs in the state. And the other issue about that Dean was mentioning about the about some Republicans, many business people in the southern part of the state support this project. It's a regional thing as well. I mean, a lot of the argument is, what are the people in the North Country? Why would they want to support this kind of rail project? They're not going to have anything to do with it. And I think that the same goes with this whole idea. You know, the bridges are in need to be fixed everywhere in the state, and the roads are also in a need to be repaired in every part of the state.
I mean, one thing that ought to be noted that the Senate this week did pass a bill that would facilitate, you know, public-private partnerships around rail. So, you know, the discussion's obviously continuing.
Yeah, well, that is a good point. The proponents are not giving up on this. They really they believe very firmly in the need for this.
Well, we got an interesting comment from Doug on this on Facebook. He says, at this point, the issue is moot. 20 years ago, the rail made sense, but with the increase in telecommuting and the fact that we're maybe 10 years away from widespread self-driving cars, it's going to be outdated. Doug, thank you for those comments. Josh, I did want to ask you about a really tough topic concerning DCYF, Division of Children, Youth and Families. The Executive Council this week approved a contract for an outside company to conduct a review of DCYF. So what prompted this, Josh?
Well, there's been a lot of scrutiny at DCYF for several years. There was a high-profile death of a four-year-old who she and four siblings were returned to her mother and her mother's boyfriend's custody, even though there were child abuse charges pending against them. She ended up dying, you know, blunt force trauma. There have been other incidents. And so the legislative panel looked at DCYF. There are a number of bills aiming to reform and bolster DCYF pending. There was one that, interestingly, they passed this week that added opioid use or drug dependence as a sort of prima facie condition of defining abuse that cleared the Senate
for removal. Yeah,
to start a proceeding. Mm-hmm. That passed yesterday, and that was an interesting issue. But I mean, the contract that went through the council, I was a consultant from Maryland. They're going to be doing a 7-month investigation. They're going to be one thing they'll be doing is they're going to be pulling 100 cases at random and sort of doing a performance audit on what DCYF did. DCYF would tell you that they welcome this review. They say that their caseload has increased 17% over the past 4 years with the same amount of staff. The drug issue has complicated their life. Mental health services in the state and problems there has complicated their life. So, you know, there's a lot going on this topic, and you know, we'll see what the review reveals.
So the review will look at the question that I think everybody had, which is, hey, DCYF, how could you return these four children to this family and one of them died terribly?
Well, I think that's going to be looked at, but I think it's not so specific. I mean, I think it's more of a general kind of performance audit sort of thing. And obviously the people who are advocating for more resources for DCYF like the timing of this, since it will be concluded at about the time the next state budget will be getting going.
So, Dean Spiliotis, this has been an issue for some time, and what I understand is that with the opioid crisis, DCYF says it's getting more instances of child abuse and neglect because more parents are, you know, strung out on drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. It clearly seems to be a worsening problem, and you do have that overlap between drug abuse and child abuse and child welfare. This is a problem that you see child welfare agencies around the country and the states struggling with, not enough staff, huge caseloads, just an inability to follow up on a lot of cases. And you do have these tragic stories around the country of children dying, and everybody wonders, well, there were signs, why wasn't the child taken away, et cetera. And so obviously it's a problem here as well.
I mean, one thing that's interesting about the bill that adds essentially drug dependence to the child protection statute is the debate in the Senate floor is very interesting. State Senator Kevin Avard of Nashua made the point that if you read the statute right now, there's no specific. It's is there harm being done to a child? It doesn't define conduct by a parent. It just says conduct that contributes to harm to the child. And some were leery about sticking in specific language dealing with drugs and something when the law is really designed just to protect the children. And this was the original bill that was amended, and that language regarding the drug use will sunset if the law passes as passed by the Senate in 2020. And this was an amendment that ended up being offered a compromise by Senator Molly Kelly. And she said, well, you know, we hope by 2020 that, you know, this drug problem is something that's behind us. And, you know, that may be optimistic, but it was interesting. It was interesting to hear that debate.
They do that a lot, don't they, Josh? Sorry, Jeff, I just wanted to clarify. They do that a lot, don't they, Josh? When they can't reach agreement, they say, well, let's sunset it, right?
Well, that's one tactic.
Yeah.
It's one of the tactics.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Because I haven't followed this as closely, and I was curious, when they talk about drug dependency, what about alcohol dependency? Does that come under that umbrella as well? Because that's just
a good question.
Because so alcohol dependency is not going to be, even though that's often, it's actually almost a worse problem in some ways in terms of abusing.
Well, that's not specifically contemplated. This is language specifically getting at the opioid crisis.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, again, if somebody's has an alcohol problem, the conduct may end up in neglect that is detected. And so, you know, you may get there that way, but no.
Well, and speaking of drug addiction, substance abuse, Josh, there was supplemental funding given to the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention. I appreciate the point there, Jeff. Additional money for hiring an attorney for the AG's office to prosecute drug cases and some other money. So there was an effort to address this in a variety of ways.
Well, I mean, that's an ongoing fight and, you know, somewhat partisan. Everybody is interested in doing what the state can to address this problem. But on the Senate floor, there was a pretty spirited debate where Democrats were saying that there's more money to spend. We ought to deal with this now, that there's not going to be that, you know, while some federal money is coming, it's not going to be large as might be hoped for. Some Republicans are saying, look, we need to know if we're spending this well. We can't just throw money at the problem. And they point out that in the last year, the funding has increased rather dramatically. The numbers they were using, I haven't verified these, is this raised from $4 million to $84 million has now been earmarked. And there are separate bills out there that would create drug courts and other things that were products of the Commission on Drugs that convened over the summer.
Well, I want to talk about the federal money in just a moment, but a couple more state house votes to follow up on. And Jeff, the House voted yes to increase the cap on what's called net metering. Now, we've done whole hours of programming on this, but what's this cap all about?
Well, first of all, net metering is when if you have like a renewable energy system at your home, or
usually
in your business,
solar panels,
and you produce more energy, generate more energy than you need, you sell it back to the utility. Basically, that's the, you know, basic explanation of it. And
so your bills go down. So it's good for you.
Yeah, and under state law, this utility is required to pay a rate for this energy, but they put a cap of 50 megawatts total for the state. The bill that was approved yesterday would basically double that cap to 100 megawatts.
Which people are already saying is not enough.
Yeah. The industry is I think, not too happy. The solar industry, which has been growing pretty substantially in the last few years, even in a state like New Hampshire. But the original bill would have put it at 75 megawatts. So I think it's an attempt to say, well, look, we're trying. We're doubling this. And it's a concern. We had a story in our paper how the cap was hit. And all these other projects could not go through, would not be eligible for net metering because the cap was just hit at 50 megawatts. For certain utilities have certain caps. It's a little more complicated than that.
But in general, Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, the utilities, they're willing to go along but only to a certain point because this ends up costing them some money.
I mean, at a certain point it becomes, are you buying it? I mean, the way it works is you're essentially like rolling back the meter. And at a certain point, some people would say, well, if you're selling the power back, you know, would it necessarily be at the retail rate?
That's a big sticking point. Actually, the BAA has mentioned, is very vocal on this, about how they're paying a full-blown retail rate when they should be paying the wholesale rate or whatever. And it's because ratepayers who are paying this, the bill.
Jump in real quick,
Dean. It's fascinating to me. We've covered these energy stories for many years here, and now to be in a position where there's actually too much solar energy being developed is just remarkable to me.
New Hampshire.
Yeah, the rap on it for years has been that it's too heavily subsidized, and now we're actually people really want to do it.
Well, more weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a moment. Stay with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to state and national politics, including a state lawmaker who resigned this week and later New Hampshire reverberations around the debate over filling a vacant U.S. Supreme Court seat. As always, you can join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love your questions, comments, and thoughts as we wrap up some of the top headlines from around the Granite State. Our guests this week are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And lots of political stories to wrap up, gentlemen. And Josh, to you first. A House member resigned this week, as I said, three-term Republican lawmaker Kyle Tasker. And we talked about this last week, but just very quickly remind us, please, what got Kyle Tasker into trouble last week?
Well, he went to meet what he believed allegedly was going to be a 14-year-old girl for sexual reasons, and he was met by law enforcement. They had been trading instant messages, and that's so he drove to a beach and showed up for sort of an assignation, and he was met by law enforcement. They then searched his house. They found lots of drugs. It suggested that he was dealing marijuana,
sort of packaged
psychedelic
what looked like
mushrooms,
to be for sale.
Suboxone. So he's got some problems, and he resigned.
Yeah, and so he resigned. This resignation sounds like, Josh, was not a surprise. He was under a lot of pressure to.
Well, he's not going to be going. I mean, for sure.
Yeah. And there was can't go to the
he
house.
Was, they were going to be voted. I mean, they were going to vote. They were going to vote him out. If he didn't.
And any word, Josh, about a special election yet to fill this seat? I know this is all still happening.
No, but the other. I mean, there was another rep actually who faced expulsion this week who managed to remain in the House. This is Don Lehman. He's a Republican from Rochester, and he had moved out of his district essentially, and then he had voted in his new district, which then triggered some concern, and they said you're not living there. Your vote proves that you're no longer a representative of your constituents, and so the House was prepared to remove him. He apparently got an apartment back in his old district, so he's in the clear for now and is going to remain in the House. So there are going to be potentially two removal votes this week, and it's a body of 400. It's a low bar of entry to the House. It's a culture where it attracts a lot of character, so it's not uncommon for people to do things that might trigger a removal vote. It's very rare for it to get to the point where a vote is actually taking place. I believe it hasn't been since like 1919 that the House has actually voted to expel somebody. Normally it gets to where somebody might be on the cusp of expulsion and they step aside.
Yeah, low bar of entry.
The charges that Representative Tasker faces are really pretty severe,
and as opposed to
residency requirements. Yeah. And this would have been a major concern for the House. I know the Speaker immediately said
he took him off his committee.
Yeah,
he's on the Children and Family Law Committee.
Yes.
This wasn't the committee that Tasker chose. I mean, Tasker was sort of on the outs with House leaders. He has made controversial postings on Facebook in the past, sort of off-color jokes.
And he dropped his gun.
I was in the room when that happened. He used to sit on the Criminal Justice Committee, and there was a thump. And we look around, and he's sort of sheepishly reaching under the table to get his pistol. And at the time, he said that this was a couple of years ago that he had not properly fastened the latch on his holster, and that he had just given blood, and that this sort of thing was bound to happen sooner or later. So he's got a lot of rough attention in the past. This is a totally different order of magnitude.
Well, also this week in Concord at the federal courthouse, there was more news in the case of Tea Party activist Jerry DeLamis. The judge in this case said DeLamis will remain in custody pending trial after his arrest on federal conspiracy charges last week. And Dean, we talked about this last week, so we don't need to go into it too much. But again, just remind us, this is related to NPR had a big story on this morning, the whole Clive and Bundy standoff in Nevada.
The standoff in Nevada over grazing rights and fees to graze your cattle on federal lands. And Jerry DeLamis went down there, he says, after the kind of most fraught moment where something might have happened. So, and kind of is being accused of being kind of a mid-level organizer of this group of people who were in the standoff with the federal authorities. There have been a number of people protesting and showing up to support him at the courthouse. Basically, the issue is whether or not to give him bail. The suggestion is that he's not really a flight risk, but the judge has temporarily required him to be held until the jurisdiction for the trial can be transferred to Nevada.
Yeah, why is she saying that she's not going to let him go on bail, Josh?
Well, I mean, I think that the government makes a case that this is a man who drove across the country, brought a sniper rifle to a standoff with law enforcement, and Facebook postings suggested that he said he would be willing to die reluctantly fighting for the Bundys who were on the other side of the law from the federal government.
Yeah.
Like, that's not the sort of thing that federal authorities take lightly. I was in the courtroom for the hearings with Jared DeLamis, and I've known him for a number of years. I've dealt with him on political stories. And, I mean, it was very interesting to listen to the testimony. You had several state representatives. You had a neighbor who got up there, and she said he's very, very conservative. He had one neighbor get up and testify, and she said, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter. I don't agree with his politics at all, but, you know, he's a kind man. He's a family man. He is somebody who is there for me. He's a peaceful person. You know, several state representatives described him as being a peacemaker in intense situations regarding political rallies. We'll see where this goes. The charges he faces are quite serious. He had a federal public defender for the first two hearings. He now apparently has hired Mark Sisti, well-known New Hampshire criminal lawyer, to be his attorney. We'll see where this goes. I mean, he's one of, I believe, 18 people charged in association with the Bundy standoff in 2014. This is not having to do with Oregon. This is in 2014.
So in this instance, Josh, DeLamis's words perhaps came back to haunt him that, you know, earlier he had said he would not cooperate with federal court orders or federal law enforcement. The judge said that conditions of release ordered by the court are monitored by federal officers. Yeah. So she kind of said, look, I can't put those two things together.
Well, that was one thing that came up at the hearing when several state lawmakers, Warren Groen, John Burt, David Bates all testified on his behalf, and you know, the takeaway from several of them was, like, you know, Jerry's a man of his word. He will show up. And so the prosecutor stood up and say, so he's a man of his word. He said, you know, he's willing to die. Okay, no more questions from me. And so, you know, we'll see where this goes. But this is obviously, these are some serious charges he faces.
And I also have to say that Mr. DeLamis was sort of like one of the unofficial spokespersons at the Bundy Ranch at the time. He was on, you know, news and TV and all this stuff. And, you know, he wasn't like just a guy who said, I want to go see what the action is. He apparently went there to take part in
the action.
And
some of the Facebook photos you can see of them all. I mean, it looks like a military brigade.
Well, this week, a Democratic fundraising group began airing attack ads against Republican senators over this issue, guys, of the GOP in the Senate saying that they will not back any nominee put forward for the U.S. Supreme Court from President Obama. Now, I'm guessing they are running this kind of ad in other states, but here's the version against New Hampshire U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte. Let's just hear a little bit of that.
Delay, delay, delay.
Donald Trump wants the Senate to delay filling the Supreme Court vacancy so he can choose the nominee next year. And Senator Kelly Ayotte is right there to help. Ayotte joined Trump and party bosses in refusing to consider any nominee, ignoring the Constitution. Newspapers call Ayotte's actions.
Okay, so again, that's a little bit of the ad. And Dean Spiliotis, let's just first of all say, for the record, Donald Trump is not the nominee. Kelly Ayotte does not seem that thrilled about Donald Trump being the nominee. But here's this ad linking them.
Yeah, this is part of a concerted effort by Democrats to take back the Senate. The ad was run by Senate Majority PAC, which is Harry Reid, the Senate Minority Leader's super PAC. So, you know, there's a sense that even if the House isn't susceptible to flipping over to the Democrats, that the Democrats do have a chance to take over the Senate. So, the Democrats are going to try to tie various candidates to Trump whenever possible. I mean, he is the front runner at this point, has a good chance of being the nominee at this point. And it's going to be part of Democrats attempting to paint Kelly Ayotte as being extreme.
Well, let's go to our listeners, gentlemen. And again, the number 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. And Michael's calling in from Portsmouth. Hi, Michael. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Hello, Laura. Thank you. I just wanted to comment on that exact point that you just brought up. By doing the math, Obama still has 22.9% of his presidency left at the time of Scalia's death. I would say that robbing the American public of their elected leaders' privileges is really pretty criminal. And that's about as far as I'd like to go.
Well, Michael, thank you for the call. And, Dean, this is an argument that Democrats have been making,
this
for sure.
Classic bare-knuckle politics. The Republicans point to a speech by Joe Biden a number of years ago in which he made the exact argument that they're making about waiting to appoint a new justice. You know, President Obama is going to go through the process. He has every right to nominate a candidate. But the Democrats right now don't have the votes to put this through. So the argument is, you know, elections have consequences. The Democrats lost the Senate in 2014, and so this is the result of that. I mean, it has a potential to be a public relations problem for the Republicans, but they seem dead set on not having hearings at this point, and technically they have the votes to do that.
Jeff?
But the Democrats do seem to think this is a winner for them as
political
an
issue.
Even if they don't get
The nominee. Polls have consistently showed that the majority of those surveyed want to see someone come to be nominated and be voted on, whether they support it or not. That's what, you know, they are against the Republican stand on this, and that's not going to be a great thing for them in the in the future.
Josh?
Late last week, Senator Ayotte was engaged in what amounted to sort of a campaign kickoff. She brought in Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa and Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, and they traveled the state a little bit late in the week, and I caught up with the trio in Hooksett. And, you know, the first person after, as soon as Kelly got done talking, you know, immediately someone was right up there in her face. I mean, it was somebody basically claiming to be Republican who really wasn't, once I started talking to them, saying that they were concerned about, you know, what this meant for the Republican Party, and that, you know, it was going to hurt the Republican Party. And, you know, Ayotte said, and this is what she's been saying all along, is basically like she believes that this is too important, that the people need to weigh in. I did talk to several people, you know, Republicans who were there who were going to be supportive of Senator Ayotte, but, you know, off the record, were kind of essentially saying, well, you know, I'm not sure this is the greatest idea. You know, the Constitution says president shall nominate with the advice and consent of the Senate. You know, they don't necessarily have to vote his pick in, but, you know, why not just at least see them? And, you know, Ayotte's on stage saying that what she wants to do is bring New Hampshire values to Washington, not, you know, the other way around. And you know, certainly one reason why Democrats are pleased with this is that, you know, this is about as nakedly sort of a Washington kind of move as, or at least can be cast that way as possible. I mean, you know, as far as if you're a Republican senator, it's a you know, you're in a tough spot. And particularly Ayotte's been a little bit worried about challenges from the right. I mean, how serious any of those are. But, you know, if you have people saying essentially we're going to run candidates in the general, you know, to try to sabotage you, you know, all of this is factoring in. And, you know, you have to be you want to get money from people who are dead set on holding the line on this. It's like a tough political calculation.
So it's a big issue, and that's why they're putting out this ad so early, because they realize it's going to be a big issue. We've got some Facebook comments on this, too, gentlemen. Colin says, why defend her, meaning Ayotte? She's an obstructionist looking out only for a potential national position. She could care less about people in New Hampshire or the public at large. David says they don't have to attack her for doing that. She's doing a fine job keeping Obama in check. That is her job. That is why we voted for her. Thanks for those Facebook comments. You're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. So let's talk a little bit more about the U.S. Senate race. And Josh, you mentioned it, that Kelly Ayotte may face some challenge in a primary. Dean, this week someone announced that he was going to challenge Senator Ayotte in the Republican primary.
That's right. Jim Rubens is going to be back in action. The last time we saw him, he was running for the Republican nomination to challenge Jeanne Shaheen against he ran against Scott Brown. He did lose, and Brown ultimately ended up losing to Jeanne Shaheen in 2014. He's been around for a long time, former state representative, former candidate for statewide office as well. You know, he said that he supported Kelly Ayotte in 2010, but that he's been disappointed with her in the past few years. So he's going to get back in. You know, for people who are on social media and follow Twitter and the like, there has been pressure from conservatives in the state for some sort of challenge to her because they feel like she's moved too far to the center. So Jim Rubens is the first one in. Perhaps we'll see some others as well.
Although Jim Rubens is Jeff Feingold, putting it very simply, to the left of Senator Ayotte, I would think, right? He's not a conservative challenger.
Some of the issues he was pushing were
Sounds right to her.
But the other thing I wanted to say, though, in terms of him being the conservative in the Republican primary, because this is something historical, is that he has been pro-choice the whole way through, and I don't know how that's going to play.
It may not be who these people had.
You know, exactly,
conservatives may not have had him in mind, but
I think he came in was kind of a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, he's hard to understand quickly in terms of like the
hard
issues,
to pin down.
Yeah,
especially on environmental issues, exactly.
And also, you know, he's a sort of newly minted Donald Trump supporter as well, which, you know, I know I was surprised by, given the extent to which he's worked against casinos in the state, that he would say that he supported Trump. And you know, what he said is essentially is like, there is no perfect candidate. And, you know, I believe that he's the man who can bring change to Washington to the greatest degree.
Well, speaking of the U.S. Senate, gentlemen, Kelly Ayotte and Jeanne Shaheen have found common ground in trying to get more money set aside for substance abuse. The Senate this week did pass a bill aimed at opioid addiction, but not the $600 million in extra emergency funds that Shaheen and Ayotte had promoted. So there's some it's interesting. There's some bipartisanship there on the opioid issue, but not quite as far as people in New Hampshire had wanted. We do have a piece of Kelly Ayotte talking about drug abuse. Again, she and Senator Shaheen were disappointed that the emergency funding didn't pass. But here's Senator Ayotte saying she's pleased that at least this federal bill called CARA, I think that's the Comprehensive Recovery Act. Help me out with that, Dean.
Addiction Recovery Act.
That's it. Here's Senator Ayotte saying, she's pleased that this happened and making the case that House members should support it.
There are lives on the line, so I'm calling on the House of Representatives as well to take this to the floor immediately, to get this bill passed, to get it to the president's desk, because we cannot afford to wait.
Again, that's Kelly Ayotte, U.S. Senator from New Hampshire, talking about drug abuse funding. In general, guys, it's a little bit difficult to see this drug abuse issue put in political terms, Dean. I mean, here we have the same fight on Capitol Hill that we've seen in the legislature that Josh described earlier. Everybody wants to help, but how and how much and so forth.
It's a debate over cost. And that was the argument that those who oppose the additional emergency funding, I think we talked about that aspect of it last week. It's a function of cost. There's already a lot of money being pumped into this, and it's not realistic to put more in. And it kind of mirrors the debate at the state level, where, you know, a number of things were passed quickly early on. But the larger debate over the cost for some of the bigger ticket items has continued to be discussed.
Well, one more piece of political news this week, Josh. In the second congressional district, a Republican has announced his intention to run against sitting Congresswoman Ann McLean Custer, a representative Flanagan.
Yes, Jack Flanagan. He was the majority leader. He stepped down to ponder his options in terms of running for the second congressional district. He's made that official. And, you know, that's a tough district for any Republican to win in a presidential year. It's been several decades since that's happened. You know, he says he's going to give it a go and said that he's going to point to legislative accomplishments. He did say, interestingly, that he disagrees, not that it's something that the House of Representatives has any direct role in, but he disagrees with the stance that Senate Republicans have on the judicial nomination. He believes that they should allow the president to have his nominee heard.
Interesting. More weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a moment. Stay with us. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join us as we catch up on some of the top Granite State headlines of the week. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. This week, our guests are Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And gentlemen, we've covered a lot of political news, a lot of statehouse news, but Jeff Feingold, there's a couple business stories that caught our attention this week. Your newspaper had an interesting article about the Manchester airport this week. Passenger traffic has dropped 50%, Jeff, over the past decade. Wow. What happened?
Yeah. Well, the basic explanation is that because of all this airline consolidation, the industry has consolidated so much that there's just no competition very little competition. And what's happened is what really was the driving force behind the growth of Manchester Airport was when Southwest Airlines decided several years ago to use Manchester as a major base for New England. And that's when we reached 1.4 million passengers. I was 10 years ago. And then what happened was through, after this consolidation, there were openings at Logan Airport in Boston. So Southwest decided, well, we'll also leave from Boston. And what happened is it had these ramifications on airports like Manchester, TF Green in Providence, and also Hartford in Connecticut, Bradley. And all those airports have seen severe drops in traffic because they had once offered this unique airline that would go real cheap and efficient and all that. But now you would drive the extra mile or a couple of miles to go to Manchester as opposed to going to Boston. But that doesn't that's not happening that much anymore. And actually, the fares used to be cheaper when Southwest was running out of Manchester. But now they're even more expensive than they are in Boston. So there's not even that incentive. And Manchester, the airport for many years, was a great economic engine for Manchester. It was really a great facility. It still is a great facility, actually. I fly out of it. I think it's a great place. But it doesn't have the airlines that it used to, or the airline that it used to, really. I mean, the Southwest still flies out of there, but it's not as robust a schedule as it used to have.
So even people who want to fly out of Manchester, Dean, sometimes there's just not the flights.
Yeah, as Jeff mentioned, the Southwest shift to Logan was really the turning point. You could literally feel it in the next couple of years. You know, two anecdotes for me. My wife is a frequent business flyer, and she regularly flew out of Manchester for many years. Now, almost never. She almost
really?
Always has to. You just can't get the flights that you need for business travel, so she typically goes down to Logan. And then I had a friend come up from D.C. to visit a few weeks ago. I had never flown into Manchester before, managed to get a flight into Manchester, arriving in the middle of the day. And he walked into the terminal. He's like, this is a great airport, but it's completely empty. Yeah. He's like, what happened? And so it just sort of – this is a very timely story because you could feel the difference now as compared to 10 years ago.
I do know that officials at the airport have been trying really hard to lure JetBlue, which is another discount airline, to come to Manchester. But then if you see the example of Southwest sets, is that going to be a good thing? I mean, it'd be great if you have JetBlue here and maybe have some competition with Southwest to maybe lower the fares. But JetBlue could also use the same strategy. Well, we'll fly out of Manchester. We're not going to keep the prices as low because they're out of Logan as well.
Well, so that's what I was going to ask you, Jeff. Is there anything the airport can do, or is it just subject to the business decisions of the airlines?
It's the business decisions of the airlines, and also it was – when you think about it, the consolidation was also the decisions by the federal government the antitrust division, because they allowed these mergers. And Manchester, as I said, is not the only airport in the country that's been hurting from this. There's major hubs like St. Louis and others are no longer major hubs. And I don't pretend to be an antitrust lawyer or whatever, but I do know when the Justice Department approved this, it was more necessary about – I think it was about just what kind of airline traffic would be allowed as opposed to where that airline traffic would be coming from.
Wow. Well, here's an email from Jordan getting back to our commuter rail discussion. And when we talked about commuter rail this week, there was a lot of push to get a stop at the Manchester airport to help revive the airport. So Jordan says, commuter rail, long overdue. Whenever I'm looking at candidates for my reps in the New Hampshire legislature, my litmus test is in the fact of long overdue commuter rail. They don't support it, and its obvious benefits for the greater good, Jordan says. They don't get my vote, period. I love New Hampshire, he says, but I've seriously had enough of this foot dragging. Jordan, thank you for the email. Here's an email from Robin in Lebanon. This has to do with our earlier conversation about the Supreme Court nomination and whether or not the U.S. Senate will take some names from President Obama. Robin says, why not provide the president with a short list of names the Senate would specifically consider worthy of hearings, debate, and potential confirmation? Such an advisor would be wholly constitutional and would negate the brewing suggestion of obstructionism. Dean, what do you think? Will they do it? Take Robin's suggestion. Just get some names. I mean, would the U.S. Senate even consider doing that?
Boy, I think it's going to be tough. We're already hearing there's a discussion. We've had a couple candidates. I think Attorney General Loretta Lynch has taken herself out of contention to be a possible nominee. Getting her confirmed as Attorney General was enough of a challenge. So they're going to try. I think, as Jeff mentioned in our earlier discussion, I think there are some potentially helpful political ramifications for Democrats. But I would be surprised if we actually have a hearing at this point.
Yeah, I just want to mention one other thing. Just change the topic again about the airport and rail.
Sure.
That has been a long time want from people who support the airport, proponents of the airport, because they say one of the things, if we had rail That could help the airport become an international airport, because the argument is that when travelers come from Europe, they're used to having rail stations at the airport, and they expect that kind of transit. So they can go to Manchester and travel to Boston or wherever. And that has been an argument for many years about having rail and specifically having a stop at the airport.
Well, this week, this is another business story. I'll throw to you first, Jeff, but want to hear from anybody. It was reported that the Northern Pass Project was investing in the Balsams redevelopment, a very important project for the North Country, to the tune of $2 million through Northern Pass's Forward New Hampshire plan. So, Jeff, what's Forward New Hampshire?
Well, it's... styled as an economic development fund, where Forward New Hampshire, this Northern Pass subsidiary, or whatever, invests money in economic development in the North Country. That was part of their deal, saying we support the North Country. We know that we want to be friends and all that stuff.
It's sort of a good neighbor policy.
Yes, and many people up there kind of resent Forward New Hampshire, as they do pretty much anything to do with Northern Pass. But Les Otten, who's the developer of the Balsams, they accepted the money, and apparently he's also spoken in favor of Northern Pass. And when you think about it, if you talk to people in North Country, they not just love, they adore the idea of redeveloping the Balsams. On the other side, they don't exactly adore the idea of Northern Pass, especially the way it's structured now. So this is an interesting decision by Otten to accept the money. Although he's a developer and he has to raise a lot of money. $2 million is barely a drop in the bucket for this. And it's an interesting decision by Northern Pass to kind of align themselves with this much desired project up in Dixville.
Well, Northern Pass, Dean, hasn't even been approved yet. Again, this is the big hydropower project,
yep.
Coming over the border into central New Hampshire and then distributing hydropower on the New England grid. It might not get approved. So if it isn't approved, is this money wasted?
hard to say. I think, as Jeff mentioned, it would certainly benefit the economy up there. But it is interesting that that Les Otten he's saying that he doesn't think the towers will hurt tourism, that there are no strings attached to this money, and there's more money to be had potentially. It's clearly a gamble. I find it hard to believe that they're investing in this just for the heck of it. But we'll see. As we know, we've talked about Northern Pass many times, and it's kind of sort of slowly moving its way through the regulatory process. But there are lots of entry points for lawsuits, and it's just, my guess is it's going to get pushed back for a while if we see it at all.
Well, and I want to let everybody know we're doing a whole show on energy issues next week. I'm sure Northern Pass will come up in addition to some of the pipeline debates and so forth. Jeff, just your final thoughts on how fluid this whole Northern Pass situation has been.
Well, it's interesting. I had a discussion with someone just the other day who lives in the southern part of the state, and basically, the person was saying, what's the big deal about Northern Pass? We need that energy and whatever. But, you mentioned something like the gas pipeline automatically. We don't need that. And it's an interesting thing what's going on, because I think if you talk to people in North Country, you say, well, what's wrong with having a gas pipeline going through the southern part of the state? So it's a typical kind of New Hampshire NIMBY-ish kind of thing going on here.
Well, we'll jump into that with both feet on Monday. One more effort that I wanted to ask all of you about, and Josh, this has to do with the State House, so I'm going to go to you first. There's been an effort to make the State House more tourism-friendly, including better care and repair of that State House collection of New Hampshire flags, which are big draws for visitors. There's some Civil War flags that were ripped and bloodied in battle. Speaking as a mother, little kids think this is pretty cool, to go in and see these flags. But the question, Josh, has been, where does the money come from to take better care of these? There was a solution announced this week, and it has to do with, lo and behold, the State Liquor Commission.
Yes. Commemorative bottle proceeds will go to the flags. This isn't a new concept. I would agree. The flags are interesting historically. They're beautiful. When I was a child, I thought they were more exciting than I do now. But
you see them every day now.
but it's certainly a worthwhile endeavor to preserve them. And you know, they're doing it via a commemorative liquor bottle.
It's something like 87 Civil War era flags, and apparently they're enclosed in cases that have not been opened in many decades, and so there's some concern about, you know, just simply opening them up to the elements. What would be the impact on the fabric? They, as Josh mentioned, they did this in 2013 with a commemorative bottle, and they raised over $80,000. And they're thinking that this time with these two new commemorative bottles, they could raise like another $70,000. So it is a start. And you've mentioned there have been issues before about you know, opening up the State House on weekends, maybe once a month, so people
can
do tours and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, the issue with all these things is simply cost.
Yeah, and actually, I know that a couple of years ago, was it, they tried to appropriate $1 million to take care of the flags. So, I mean, it's, while you can get $75,000-$80,000 at a pop, it's still not the total price tag of something as you know, historic as this, and the kind of work needed to make sure that they come up to standards.
Well, all those fourth graders who go to the State House, that's the year that the kids do New Hampshire history. They all go to the State House, they all look at the flags, and, you know, they go, ooh. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see.
You need to have the flags there.
Cool. Well, gentlemen, I always like to close out the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup looking at what you will be covering next week, and Josh, I'll turn to you first.
Well, you know, I'm going to be – there'll be action at the State House, but I'm also going to be starting to look at, you know, the election season, like it or not, is sort of upon us. And so I'm going to be looking at the first congressional district. We already have a bunch of candidates running on the Republican side who you could argue are illustrative of the sort of churn within the GOP at the moment.
Yeah, Frank Ginta, the incumbent, vulnerable because of problems with his election funding. So there's some challenges on the right and the left for Representative
Ginta. Pam Tucker, Rich Ashew, and Dan Innes. So it's a full plate there.
Wow, already. Yeah, and the year is still young. Jeff, what are you going to be doing next week?
There's a couple of bills coming up in the Senate next week that come under the umbrella of family-friendly legislation. One is a bill that would allow employees to ask for flexible work arrangements. That they, you know, it's not necessary that they would, the employer doesn't have to grant it, but they could ask it. And another one is about giving women a place to breastfeed pregnant women. And those are, it'll be interesting to see what happens, because that's an issue that a lot of people have been paying attention to.
Okay, Dean, how about you?
Josh is absolutely right. It's really starting to feel like these statewide races are gearing up. We've got a couple new challengers in the race. There's just sort of a lot more action. I'm getting lots of funding emails from all the different candidates on both sides. So we're off and running. So I think I'm going to increasingly shift my attention to those races.
All right. All of you, thank you so much for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.